welcome in Doug Gottlieb, and this is All Ball, all basketball, all the time. We got two great guests for you upcoming. David Nurse is, he's actually the nephew of Nick Nurse, but he's also a mental coach, mental confidence coach, if you will, for the NBA. I think he does a great job. I think he's brilliant. Plus, we're going to talk about the brilliance of Kawhi Leonard, who, by my estimation, best player in the NBA. And my brother Greg, 25 years, an assistant in college basketball, recruited him. He left San Diego State, went to Cal, tried to get him at Cal. They didn't offer him a scholarship. He goes to San Diego State. We'll talk about the beginnings of Kawhi Leonard's ascension to this remarkable career. Let me give you a couple of quick thoughts on what we've seen so far. I still contend that James Harden, I don't know if it's conditioning or if he just naturally doesn't have the wind. But have you guys seen the stat where he shoots 23% from three in fourth quarters and overtimes of playoffs the last 5 years? And if you look, he did have the big block shot against Lou Dort, but that was after struggling, by his own accounts, struggling massively on offense. So you have to start to ask yourself, is it because in the postseason he plays defense, in the regular season he doesn't? Is it because of how difficult it is to score in the postseason? Or is he just not taking care of himself? Whatever it is, the conditioning's a factor. Then you go to Russell Westbrook, who played really well in Game 7. Competed, scored, kind of kept the Rockets in the game up until late, but then missed three straight layups. And it's not like they were dead layups, wide open layups, but they're contested finishes that an MVP should make. I was impressed that Oklahoma City was even in that game, even in that series, considering their lack of shooting, considering their youth. Obviously disappointed that Steven Adams doesn't even look at the basket when he'd be open for a little slip the entire second half, and he never seemingly did. I would have had Chris Paul take the ball in bounds just because he's the best passer, and I feel like Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, as much as I love him, I have some concerns about long-term his ability to be a superstar, right? Like a superstar lead guard in transition, two-on-ones, three-on-ones, three-on-twos, that should be a layup or wide-open shot every time, and it's not. He's an average passer. And when you're an average passer that's eventually going to be a dominant ball-handling guy, that does limit you. It does limit you. Let me get to Steve Nash. It's a surprise that he's the head coach. I'm not going to sit here and deny that. I didn't know Steve Nash wanted to be a head coach. I didn't know that Brooklyn was considering him. But the idea that he got the job because of white privilege, that's what Stephen A. Smith said, is the most laughably obtuse comment I've heard in a long time. And I've heard a lot of laughably obtuse comments. I'm not saying that black coaches shouldn't get a chance, and many of them have succeeded. And but I'll tell you this, where were the calls about guys getting jobs they quote-unquote didn't deserve when former black players, Doc Rivers got the Orlando Magic job. You go to Derek Fisher, Mark Jackson, Isaiah Thomas. Jason Kidd got the Nets job. Nobody was like, hey, he's never coached a job. He got the job over a white guy. Like, no, he was replacing. Wasn't he replacing P.J. Carlesimo? Or did P.J. Carlesimo actually replaced him and did a damn good job, by the way? We do this thing where we always default to race having to play a part. Race doesn't play a part here. I mean, we all know what's at play. He's got a relationship with Sean Marks. He's a superstar player. He's coached Kevin Durant before. He's really well respected. By the way, he's actually African by birth and Canadian in terms of nationality. He's been around the game. And if there's, can you find a guy who Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving respect? Respect. Outside of somebody who has a championship ring, you're not going to bring Phil Jackson there. And Greg Popovich probably turned down the job. I don't think he wants to coach those dudes at this point. There isn't anybody that you respect more than a two-time MVP like Steve Nash. The Steve Nash thing is this. You hire people to do what you don't know how to do. For example, Jock Vaughn, who's been a head coach. And there's no malice towards Jock Vaughn for me. I love Jock Vaughn. He was awesome in high school. And we beat them his senior year. His last game was against Tustin High School. He played for John Muir High School. Same high school, by the way, that produced Stacey Augmon. Pretty awesome, right? Pasadena. So, and I remember I went to Superstar Camp when I was going to be a freshman, and I saw him play in like the All-Star game, and I was like, that's the best point guard I've ever seen in person. I was like a Bobby Hurley guy going, I'm like, Jock Vaughn's the best point guard I've ever seen in person. He's a big reason I wanted to go to Kansas, because he was at Kansas, because he was a California guy, pass first, point guard, whatever. But you keep him on staff because he's been a head coach. He knows the guys. He knows the culture. Like, he's a tip of the cap to what they've been doing. But if Jock Vaughn really had the respect and attention of his stars, superstars, Kyrie and KD would have been on the plane and been in Orlando supporting the team. They would have. DeAndre Jordan wouldn't have opted out. I know they won without those guys, but just them not showing up tells you all you need to know. Because you're not, you can win 5 out of 8 games in the bubble. You're not winning an NBA championship unless you get those guys to give you everything they have and to lead. I truthfully and honestly don't understand any backlash because Steve Nash is white, other than the time in which we're overreacting and we can't do this. We can't make every story about race. Look, we don't, of the police brutality incidents, first, we don't know if it's the incident in Kenosha. I don't understand. It feels like excessive force bordering on police brutality. It does, despite the fact that guy was the guy who his ex-girlfriend called on. He had an outstanding warrant. Like, that's at minimum excessive force, feels like police brutality. But I don't know. I don't know if it rises to the level of murder. Like, that's going to be for a district attorney and for a judge and jury of his peers to figure out. But we have no idea whether or not that had anything to do with race. Do you? Of course you don't. But what we do is, with those stories, we automatically say it has to be racial injustice. It has to be. Okay. I would commit to you that in basketball, I mean, you think Sean Marks really sees race? Sean Marks has played in the NBA, been a general manager in the NBA, been in the front office of San Antonio Spurs. Like, that's not how people in sports, especially in the NBA, think. I've never been in a place in basketball where it's ever been, hey, we got to take a white guy ahead of a black guy. Like, that doesn't occur anymore. And if you're bothered because Steve Nash doesn't have head coaching experience, that's fine. You're allowed to be. But were you bothered when Mark Jackson got a job or Jason Kidd got the next job? Were you bothered when Derek Fisher got the Knicks job? Were you bothered when Steve Kerr got the Warriors job? Were you bothered when these guys? There is a parallel. Look, if you want to feel bad for Jock Vaughn, you can. You can. Jock Vaughn's a grinder as a player, just stayed in the league as the 12th man. He's been a grinder as a coach. He's been a head coach before in Orlando. He does have experience. He did do a good job. He did. But when he was a player, when the Spurs got Tony Parker, he never got a chance to compete with Tony Parker for the starting job. He just didn't. You know, when you're a broadcaster, you can be the best in the world. When a superstar NBA or college player retires, a college coach retires, a lot of times you get leapfrogged, or you're sitting at the same desk. You're like, I've been doing this for 15 years. That's the way it works with stars. That's just the way it works for stars. And it has nothing to do with race. All right, let's welcome in our first guest of the day. Of course, his uncle is Nick Nurse. He's a mental coach for a good amount of gaggle of players in the NBA. He's David Nurse.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
Let's welcome in David Nurse. And David, how would you describe what you do for NBA players?
Well, I describe it as being a life optimization coach. And what that means is basically more in depth than just the on-court skill set, because basically a player can be on court for about 2 hours a day maximum. But what are you going to do with the 22 other hours? How are you going to optimize that time to be able to step on the floor at your peak, at your 100%? So it's NBA optimization coach, and it goes deep into nutrition, development, sleep, enhancement, overall recovery. And the biggest piece, 90% of it all, is the mindset development.
Let me ask about last night. Obviously, Nick is your nephew, is that right?
Yeah, I'm his nephew. He's my uncle. Yep.
Oh, he's your uncle. Okay, so he's your uncle, you're his nephew. And sorry, I don't know why I said.
I'm not that old.
I know.
Not that old yet.
So Nick is your uncle. Okay. Yes. How would you, like, let's say Jason Tatum, young player, okay, kind of got lost on that last play. They're up 2-0. I'm sure in your mind you're like kind of working in the mindset of, hey, we're about to be up 3-0. Now all of a sudden, you know, OG Anunoby hits a game winning three. What's the conversation like to work through with somebody like Jason Tatum, supremely confident young guy, but now there could be a crisis in confidence when you lose a game like that?
Yeah, absolutely, and that's a real thing. I mean, they were looking at this series being over, and it's a challenging thing to do, but with that situation, I would talk to him about being, okay, let's look at the big picture. It's 2-1. You guys basically stole one from Toronto early. They stole one from you here. That's even. You're still up 2-1. You have 2 games to go. You've been playing at the highest level of anybody in the playoffs. And I just really highlight how well he's done against the Raptors and how well he can continue to do against them in those situations. And basically just, I mean, show him different situations in the past where this happened and teams folded, and then different situations in the past where this happened and teams rallied around this. Because it's going to go one or the other way. Like, Boston's either going to feel bad for themselves and feel like this series should be over, or they're really going to come together and step put the foot on the gas pedal.
Okay, so what is the most common issue you work through with guys? If there is a common issue.
Yeah, absolutely. Confidence, no doubt. Confidence and developing what I call the unshakable confidence. And I have a 7-step process that I go through with players. But, I mean, basically, even the highest level players will struggle with confidence at some time. And it's how you get them out of their own mind. How you really get players understanding that, hey, at their best, at their peak, they can be that type of player every single night. And I do a lot of visualization, visualizing the game before it happens. The players that I work with will sit down, they'll see the game, how it happens, how they want it to unfold, and then they'll watch it through again, seeing, hey, now the game, something crazy went on, because there's always going to be something wild that happens during the game. So they're seeing it 2 times before they step on the floor, giving them a lot of power and knowing where they're going to get to their spots. And Kobe and MJ were really big on doing this. And I'll have each player, they'll watch their highlight reel, what they call their personal swag reel, when they wake up in the morning, before they step on the floor for practice, and before they step on the floor for the game, basically putting themselves in their mindset of this is when they are at their best. It'll be a 2 to 3 minute clip of all their best highlights put together. And it works the same way as muscle memory development does on a shot or anything, as it builds in that subconscious and builds the myelin that in the brain that this is who they are, this is who they can be at their best. And one of the biggest things that I've done, Doug, is really helping players focus on just detaching themselves from the result, because that's where it really drives confidence. When you don't see shots going in, or you get in what's called a shooting slump, which I'm big on redefining vocabulary, like words don't have to mean what we've grown up thinking they mean, but detaching from the results and focusing on the process, solely on the process. One of my players I'm working with is Norm Powell of the Raptors, and he's done an unbelievable job of just embracing this and focusing on getting to his best shots, getting to the rim and transition downhill, and getting catch and shoot threes. And he went on a span of like 15 games in a row where those are the only shots he took. And he's just really taking himself out of like worrying about made or missed shots, knowing, hey, if I get to these spots, they're going to go in over time. It's all about getting to these spots.
No question. Let's take Lou Dort the other night, right?
Yeah.
So they're not guarding him. They're daring him to shoot. They're playing the numbers. And obviously his teammates, Chris Paul, helped his encouragement. Hey, just let it fly, dude. Let's go. Which is, you know, as a guy who, I mean, I struggle with my confidence. I mean, that really kind of derailed my entire career was, you know, because people go like, you couldn't shoot. Like, no, I could shoot. I wouldn't have been recruited at the level I was recruited if I could not shoot. It's just, I would get to the point where I didn't think I could shoot. And then I would, you know, I'd work all summer. Then you come back and you get into practice and now you're tired. Maybe you work a little bit less and then you do what you do best and you stop shooting as much And now you miss some shots, and then all of a sudden your confidence goes. So you're like, all right, I just won't shoot. And then they stop guarding you. Now it becomes hard to play you. Like, it becomes this kind of vicious cycle. Let's go with Lu Dort. I love the idea. Like, everyone said, well, just shoot. Yeah, but there are times in which you're not a good shooter. You shouldn't just shoot when you're open, because that'll cause you to – how do you handle when you're left wide open?
Yeah, and that's a great point. I mean, he's got a really good encourager in Chris Paul telling him to shoot, and that's huge, as we know, as shooters, that you need that confidence from everyone else around you. But if you're not shooting it well and you're left open, I mean, attacking the rim is going to just get your juices flowing, get you more in the game than just depending on the three alone. And basically, to get yourself out of that state of, it's about me, it's determined on my shots, they're leaving me wide open, I have to make these shots, then you pour your emphasis on everything else, on how you can pour into your teammates, how are you defending, how are you moving off ball, are you getting off ball movement assists, are you getting screen assists, like just really just taking your mindset away from the importance of that shot and putting it on other aspects and areas of the game. But yeah, I mean, it's a tough and it's a real thing when you're left open, especially when you're a young player. And that's really where, because you know, it comes down to just really focusing on, hey, this is the confidence through preparation. I've done this 8 zillion times before. It's just a game. It's just a shot. I've done it. I can make it. And trusting in that. Sometimes it's tough. And I'll have players, one big thing that I do is have a what I call a cue word with them. So it's a word they'll say that'll trigger their subconscious to get them back in like just a normal even keel state. Like, if they're missing shots, one of my players' words is unshakable. Just say unshakable to himself over and over again. And it's a mindset trick to get yourself back and feel, okay, things are okay. Blood pressure's rising, but I'm going to be okay.
I like that, unshakable. Do you come up with the word? Do you let them come up with the word? How do you do it?
I let them come up with the word. They'll all come up with their own type of word. So I'll have each player, they'll have like a card that they'll go through. I'm big on confidence through comparison too. And I know that sounds kind of contradictory, but like Kobe did to MJ, find some player that you know you can be like, you can learn from them, you can steal from them, and have that confidence through comparison. So if we're going with the Norm example, his is D-Wade. So he's always thinking the D-Wade mindset. And so on his cue card of going through before the game, he's going to think of, put himself in that frame. Okay, D-Wade did this. I can do this. And I have players look at their hands, because their hands have been through everything. It's all the grit, the work that they put in. And then they see that player that they're comparing themselves to. They see their hands as their own hands, and they become one. So that's one thing that I do with them. And then it's the visualization that we talked about, seeing the game in two different ways. It's the swag highlight reel that they're going through. It's having that cue word in their mind. It's knowing where their shots come from. And it just having that blueprint, Doug, just gives them a lot of confidence. Like, you know how it is just going into a game and going in and just playing. But now you feel like you have the upper hand. Whether you do or not, at least you have that kind of, maybe call it placebo, but that kind of effect of, okay, I have a game plan here. I'm one step ahead of the competition already.
That's absolutely positively fascinating. Fascinating. You know, I tell people all the time that, and you tell me, like, look, your uncle obviously, I don't know if you know this, he coached me in the USBL.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. Oklahoma,
yeah.
Right? Oklahoma
City? He was coaching in England, and he was, and Kareem was our head coach, and he came back. I think he joined us after the season started. And anyway, like, I obviously immediately liked him, and we've remained friends. But it's fascinating to me. There's three parts of basketball, which I don't think we in the media do a good enough job discussing, that it's a major factor in team's success or team's failure, player's success or player's failure. One is culture. Like, we kind of describe culture sometimes, and we use it as a tag word. Well, they got great culture, but we don't. We don't really portray an understanding of what that actually looks like, what that actually means. Conditioning, I think, is a massive, massive factor. You know, there are times which guys are just too tired to make shots. Their body will not cooperate. And, you know, like, look, my old head coach, Eddie Sutton, he used to say, like, well, you can be tired, but you can't play tired, right? Which is a great way, but it, again, that's kind of resetting the mental. And the last part is the part that you focus on a ton, which is confidence. And I just don't, it's really interesting. Like, I would make the case to you, and you tell me if I'm wrong. LeBron's curious because, and he may have overcome it now, but there were times in his career, they played the Spurs in the finals, and they would dare him to take that mid-range pull-up, and he would have a little bit of a crisis in confidence. He'd miss a couple. He'd get a little, now sometimes he has that now kind of. You talked about Norman Powell getting to his shot. You know, he has that really weird step back where he dribbles with his right hand and steps back with his then left right. That's like his go-to where he kind of, maybe that helps him reset himself mentally. But for LeBron James to be one of the all-time greats, to me, he's maybe one of the few guys at that level who at times struggles with his confidence in his jump shot.
Man, I absolutely agree with you. And one of his big things was he was worried about what everybody else was saying about him. And when you let thoughts creep into what your legacy is or what the media is going to say, like it definitely affects players. He's gotten a lot better at it, but yeah, I totally agree with you.
Okay. So I love the process you go through with Norm. And so take me through a little bit of, like, let's say I have an 11-year-old son, 11-year-old son. And, let's say he's struggling with, you know, like last weekend we went and played, he played up. He was a little bit sped up. And, you know, when they're that young and they start shooting way too far out, they start shooting air balls. And now they think they suck. I suck. How do you approach it?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's when I come back to the drawing board and we go back in the gym and we start in close and really look at – I'd ask him a lot of self-assessment questions. I think it's really powerful when players can express what they're feeling and asking them instead of just telling them what to do. Figuring out what's going through their mind. That way it also puts more of the precedence on themselves too, the ownership on themselves. But I would ask him, hey, why do you feel like you missed those shots? What was going on? Like, what do you think was the issue? Not in a negative way, but just asking him and reflecting on it. And he'd probably be like, well, I'm not ready for that. I just couldn't make them. It wasn't a good game. I had a slump. And like a lot of times when players will say slumps, because everybody grows up thinking that like failure is a negative thing or slumps are a negative thing. So I'll ask the player, no matter what age, every time that I start working with them, hey, when was the last time you were in a shooting slump? And they'll tell you, and you'll see their body language just kind of falling, like, you know, a couple games ago, or for your son saying he's airballing shots. You're like, yeah, I just couldn't make it. It was horrible. And you see the body language just crumbling in. And then I'll ask them, hey, when was the last time you were in a shooting hippopotamus? And they'll look at me like, what are you talking about? But I use this crazy type of word just to show that, hey, slump is just a word that we've grown up in society to feel like it means something negative, to give our subconscious that negative feeling, when in reality, we can pivot that type of word. It doesn't have to mean that. So I would talk to him about that. And then I go through a lot of where he was the most confident. I'd have him really, like, tell me the exact game details, like the fans, the smells that he had, his teammates, of when he had his best game he's ever had, and have him continually to recreate that. And then I go back in the practice on the court and just give him one thing to work on, really big on just focusing on one thing, like maybe his – like that's where maybe his answer was, hey, my guide hand was really pushing the ball, and that's what we'd work on. We'd focus on that, so we'd give him a lot of confidence through the preparation of specific focus development that he needed. And it's funny you use that example, too, because Domas Sabonis is a player that I've been working with, and we're developing his three-point shot, and he shoots a flat ball. So whenever he's shooting a flat ball, like we'll go back, we'll talk about it, like, hey, this is the one thing you need to do is get your elbow to your eyebrow, get the arc up, and it's going to go in. So it gets a lot of confidence knowing that it's only one adjustment away from being a great shooter.
That's amazing. Yeah, it's fascinating. You know, I'm friends with Matt Holliday. Matt was a 7-time All-Star.
Yeah.
4-time Silver Slugger. And, you know, if you take steroid guys out of baseball, he was not, obviously not a steroid guy. You take steroid guys out of baseball, his numbers are that of Hall of Fame caliber numbers.
Yeah.
And he told me, like, a long time ago, he's like, look, the biggest thing that I learned from Scott Boras' agent was, like, process over result. And it's become his whole thing. And in baseball, it's about, you know, how's your timing mechanism? Are you seeing the baseball? Are you working to hitters' counts, you know? And because you can't control, you know, you can't control where the baseball goes. You know, they're good luck and bad luck. But you have to be, you fail so much in baseball, you have to go process over result. And, well, you try that with kids, right? Like, right? It's, I don't care if you miss a shot. Was it a good shot? Was there a great shot that was available? Did we have to take that shot? Did we run offense? Is it what we want, right? Like, did you do all of these things that you're supposed to do? And then if the ball goes in, the ball doesn't go in. And by the way, did you work on your shooting? Did you take however many shots per day, every day, so that when you got that opportunity, you made it? If you did all of that, your process is right. The results will, in fact, follow.
Man, I love that. And it's so true and so real, and it's also difficult, though, for people to think, like, okay, process over results. Like, it sounds great. It's kind of like a word. That saying is kind of like a word, like culture. Like, every NBA team throws around, we want to have great culture. But, yeah, show me what that means. Give me some tools. Give me some actual hows. Like, the why, the purpose, the Simon Sinek, he talks about that a lot. Like, that's great. But I need some tools and actionable ways to be able to implement this. And through focusing on the process over the results, like you're saying, like what I do is we never, with my players, I never look at shooting percentage. We never look at points per game. We only look at their rate of where they got to their best shots. If they got to their highest level shots, that's a win. And that's what they're tracking. And over time, that's when shots continue to go in and in more and more and more. But not focusing on the end result, but literally having tracking systems, tracking mechanisms, and it's really important. I mean, for anybody in life, like let's say you're trying to get in better shape, like you have to track your weight, you have to track things and see this progress happening. So even for kids, it's really important that they can see these results and understand that, hey, what he's saying is actually working because I am improving in this process.
Last thing, just in terms of your basketball thoughts, your uncle's team down 2-1, and you know, like you put it out, it's really hard to know what the mentality of the Celtics is going into Game 4. What do you think about the series?
I think, man, I mean, obviously I'm a little bit biased with Nick, but I think he's such a great coach that he just figures these type of situations out. I mean, the same thing happened last year with Milwaukee, and now he's really going to ride this momentum of, guys, we got new life. This is our new chance, and they're going to be really, really energized. So I honestly think the Raptors are going to win. I think they're going to win in 7. And, man, I'm good friends with Brad, too, and I know Brad's a great coach.
He's amazing.
He's going to come with a great game plan as well. So it's literally going to be like the ultimate chess game, and but yeah, I'm going Raptors in 7.
You know, it's interesting. I thought two things happened on that last play that defy conventional wisdom, and I am a big defying conventional wisdom guy, right?
Dude,
how many times have you heard you can't have a point guard take the ball inbounds as a big guy in the ball, right?
Yep.
Now you can't. Now look, part of the bubble, which and this is Kyle Lowry's basketball intelligence, is there's no fans behind you, so you can back up as much as you want, right? So you have more space than you do in an NBA arena. But that pass would not have been on time, on target, if anyone, I believe, other than – why would you have somebody who passing isn't what they do best take the ball inbounds? Additionally, that kind of defies the whole logic of having a big guy on the ball. Yeah, I think those two things, you don't always have to have a big guy in the ball. Like, especially 0.5 seconds to go, 0.5 0.5 seconds to go. You can play 5-on-4 on defense.
Yeah.
Instead, make that fifth guy a super active guy. But what happens is coaches have a tendency to do what everybody else does because that's what everybody else does. And challenging that, and congratulations to Nick for like, fuck that. Let's have Kyle take it in. You know, like, look, I don't know if Steven Adams would have taken a layup or read the play, but I do think that if Chris Paul would have taken the ball in bounds the night before instead of Shea Alexander, who is a point guard but not really a very good passer, you know, his limit, he was running the play. That was what he was doing. He was like that young kid in high school. It's like, comes in like, what's the play, coach? We're running the play. That's what we're doing.
Yeah. Hey, you know what? I got a lot of points on that too, and you're super right. Like, absolutely, have your best passer taking it out. It's like having a quarterback. Like, why would you put your running back in there to take the ball out of bounds? But to your point on Nick, like, that's why he's so good. He doesn't do what everybody else does. Like, he played a triangle and two in the finals last year. Everybody's like, oh, that's crazy.
Yeah,
it won. Like, he studies with Bill Belichick. Like, all these different, like, one of his big things was taking the best player out of the game. That's why you've seen the Lakers really struggle against the Raptors, because they're so LeBron-based. But he just absolutely doesn't matter what. He'll triple-team the guy to take him out of the game, because that is the head of the snake. So he doesn't care what conventional wisdom says. And it's funny, too, because I see that and I get so excited because it's OG hitting that, and he's one of my guys I've worked a lot with. And the amount of reps that he's put in shooting quick catch and shoot corner threes, like, we've shot thousands and thousands and thousands of them. I mean, maybe not at that kind of, like, just get it up there like a hot potato, but hey, it's all that preparation, that unseen work that he has put in. The dude puts in a ton of work to be able to get to that opportunity to have a chance to hit the game winner.
That's a great point. Hey, listen, man, obviously you do great work. We really appreciate you coming on. And you, like me, we love hoop and love hoopers. Yep. And love that you're helping hoopers hoop. So thanks for joining me.
Absolutely, man. Hey, let's get your 11-year-old in the gym. Let's get his confidence back.
Let's do it. I'll tell you where we play when we work out, and you come work with him.
I'm on.
Thanks for joining
me. Thanks, Doug.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific.
All right, let's welcome in my brother, Greg Gottlieb, longtime 25-year college basketball assistant. And the one that got away, right? That's like what coaches have a tendency to sit around and talk about. And I was watching Kawhi last night, and I don't know if you saw this, on mid-range jump shots in the playoffs, granted in the bubble, he's shooting 80% from the floor. Like, he's so good. He plays both ends. He's become a very good ball handler passer. And I wanted to bring you on because you did recruit him. You were a fan. I remember you texting me saying, like, how could Kawhi Leonard not be McDonald's All-American when he's the Gatorade, the California Gatorade State Player of the Year? First time you saw Kawhi, do you remember when it was?
Yep, I do. He was a junior, and they were playing in the sports arena in, I believe, the CIF semifinals or finals, and they were playing against Dominguez High School, which at that time Dominguez was a powerhouse, and Jordan Hamilton was really the premier player
Jordan
coming
Hamilton.
Up. And so I was recruiting both Jordan and Kawhi. And for the first three quarters, Kawhi just did an incredible job defensively on Jordan Hamilton, who was at the time an exceptional offensive talent. And Dominguez just pulled ahead at the end. I think Kawhi kind of ran out of gas, but he was exceptional. And really at the defensive end more than at the offensive end at the time, but always had athleticism, ability to attack the basket. You know, he wasn't a great shooter at that time, but he was a guy who could score going downhill.
You know, I've always thought, like, what you possess and what guys who have done what you do possess is something that I think it's a great skill, which is the ability to watch a 16-year-old, 17-year-old kid, or maybe sometimes even 15-year-old kid, and project what he would look like in a college basketball game, not just in terms of your offense, what his body looks like, maybe. And see, look, some of it's guessing, I would assume, right? You look at a guy's hands, is he still going to grow? You see the parents, you know, how mature is he? Is he going to put on weight? Is he not going to put on weight? But it's, you know, what you're doing is you're projecting in watching Jordan and Kawhi. And I agree, you know, Jordan Hamilton went to Texas and played. And obviously his brothers, one played at UConn, one played at UCLA. But when you watch them at that particular time, do you remember, did you think Kawhi would be a better player than Jordan Hamilton?
No, you know, I think the big thing, to be honest, Jordan, still super talented player. I would imagine he's still playing right now if he's not. He may be playing overseas if he's not in the NBA. But you know, he's a little bit of the victim of his own success.
Yeah.
You know, because he had so much success, people telling him how great he was a little bit, and maybe allowed him to develop some habits that actually held him back a little bit. I know he struggled a little bit at Texas, but, you know, Kawhi didn't have all that. You know, he didn't have those accolades. You know, he was a talent, but maybe a hidden talent at the time. And, you know, we can say he was under-recruited. There's other things, circumstances that go into some of those decisions that people made. At that time, people were getting commitments early in the Pac-12 and really the Pac-10 at the time. So people were taking kids, you know, going into their junior year, they were trying to get commitments. And so sometimes, you know, you make mistakes. But so some people stop recruiting those positions because they already had a commitment for a kid, and he just kept getting better. You know, and again, he didn't have the fanfare, but I think what he really had was the work ethic to go with the ability. The thing that he had probably the most that stood out the most was his ability to rebound the ball. That probably is what made him such a consistent player, though. You know, I mean, that always seems to translate every level you go up if you're a good rebounder. And he was a guy who could get you 10, 12 rebounds in every game. And I think he just had a nose to the ball. I think he's fearless. I think he's tough. And he plays hard.
It's interesting, right? Because I know that some coaches looked at him and like, 6'5", 6'6", like he can rebound in high school, but you can't rebound in college. Because at the time, that was when big guys were big guys, and he was, though he played inside, he was the size of a wing. How hard is it to figure out the translation of rebounding and size in high school versus in college?
I still think guys that rebound, doesn't matter what position they are, you know, guards even that are really good rebounders, are going to find, they just have a knack and a feel for where the ball is coming off of it. But also they're anticipating, it's just kind of built into what they do. So I always found rebounding is probably the number one skill. And it didn't surprise me that San Diego State at the time recruited him because I had, you know, just recently left there. And that was a big thing for us when I was at San Diego State. If you were 3, 4, or 5, you had to be a guy that could get double figure rebounds in a game. And so we weren't always a great shooting team, but we could make up for it by getting extra possessions on the glass, things like that. I thought that was something that like I said, that he was really good at. You know, the thing that always is interesting, you know, is initially when you're out recruiting and you know, you have kind of a system that you're recruiting to, let's say, and you know, all right, well, we need a 4-man or we need a 5, and we want them to look like this size, that size. And then, but in the end of the day, you know, once you get your team together, you're going to play the guys that give you the best chance to win. And so you make some adjustments. And it's funny that he was kind of that tweener, right? He wasn't truly a wing at that point in his career and development. But so he was kind of on the bubble of being a 3 and a 4, as long as you see. But, you know, when you're on the other side defending those guys too, you're like, who do we have to guard him? He's too big for a wing, and he's too quick for a big guy, you know? And so, when we don't have one of those guys, you're like, why don't we have one of those guys?
You know, it's what's fascinating is you mentioned San Diego State where you had coached. Like, he checked so many boxes of what San Diego State has feasted on, right? Like, a little bit under-recruited, either Riverside or Sacramento. Like, those are kind of two spots where you guys, I thought, did LA as well. But Riverside and Sacramento are two spots where you guys did a really good job. They've continued to do a really good job of recruiting, right? Tweeners. And guys that maybe what they lack on offense, they make up for in work ethic and defense and rebounding, right? Like he felt like you're describing a San Diego State player. The other side to it though is that, like, look, I'm sure they knew they were getting a really good player, a terrific player, and I know that you badly wanted to take him at Cal. But do you think in any way they knew he would be this?
No, and people don't realize too. Even at San Diego State, they one of the things that really helped was they signed his best friend at the time. Kid that he didn't make grades, I don't think. So
who's
he
that?
Ended up not going there, but I can't remember his name. A little guard, really quick. good player, but just didn't have, he was kind of, you know, on the bubble academically and didn't make it, but that was another factor in them getting involved with him. No, I don't know that they ever truly do, and you never totally know who's going to be that guy that emerges. Sometimes the kid that you think is going to be, you know, in your recruiting class, you think this one particular kid might turn out to be really, really good in it. And as it turns out, it's someone else that maybe you didn't project a little bit. But obviously, like we said, I mean, he had some physical ability. He had broad shoulders, got long arms. Obviously, everyone talks about his hand size. So, you know, he had a frame that could fill out as well. But I think, you know, you're trying to investigate really when you're recruiting, like, you know, how strong is their desire and their will to get better. And I think that is really what separated Kawhi, you know. I mean, it's just no different than, you know, Kobe, LeBron, Michael Jordan. You know, some of these guys, really, it's not so much that they're that much better of an athlete. It's just their will to prepare, or what motivates them to want to, you know, to play is so different. You know, some of these guys, their whole goal is to make it to the NBA or to get a big contract, and then they take their foot off the gas and, you know, they change. And the big question a lot of people is, how do you handle success? You know, everyone always talks about how you handle failure, but how do you handle success? So for a lot of these guys, you know, they get money, and now all of a sudden, you know, they're not working as hard, or they're interested, you go in other places. But these guys, guys like Kawhi, you know, he loves to dominate a game. I mean, he loves to work. You know, the work for him is the reward. You know, so that, I think that's really where the separating factor. Obviously, he has some incredible ability, but I think there's a lot of guys in the NBA with similar type of ability, but they don't have the mindset that he has that really has separated him, and the will and work ethic.
What did you think of Harden when he was in high school?
You know, it's funny because James was on a really talented high school team too, and I can't remember the big kid's name they had. They had a really good big kid.
Artesia, right? And they had Derek Glasser was like his personal attaché, whatever.
And they had another wing too, who was much higher regarded early on. And I think, again, the thing with James, I mean, he was a guy that could score, not a great scorer, but a good scorer, not a great athlete. But same thing with him. I mean, he's figured it out. Like, you know, it's just things have – I think he's probably one of those guys that's really put a tremendous amount of time into his game and really fine-tuned it. And, you know, the NBA is really the rules have really helped him too, obviously. But from an offensive standpoint, I don't know there's anybody better at being able to get their own shot anytime they want and make people pay for helping. I mean, but his ball handling is exceptional. You know, I mean, and his ability to get his shot is exceptional. And obviously he's got range.
He can really pass, really pass too. He's got good vision,
yeah.
You know. What's interesting about it is, I agree, he's obviously put a ton of time into it. He doesn't appear to be in the greatest of shape at times, which is weird. Like, I don't know if he has a personal kind of limitation in terms of in-game conditioning. Last one, Russell Westbrook, his teammate, right? So you got, now, first time you saw Russell was when?
You know, Russell was a guy that was kind of under the radar. You know, I think University of San Diego was the only one that had offered him a scholarship going into his senior season. And, you know, really the first time I saw him was in a tournament in Westchester, I believe it was. And going into, you know, in his senior year, people were kind of talking about him. And by that time, he's one of those guys that, like, if you looked at him physically as a going into his senior year, and then you looked at him once he got to college, you would have thought that someone literally stole his identity. He's using his name because, I mean, he physically completely changed. Even in his face completely changed. I mean, he just matured incredibly in that time period, you know, and give Kerry Keating a lot of credit because he's the one that saw him. And really during that time period when UCLA was really good, they did a great job of evaluating guys that were in their area that were kind of sleepers, Darren Collison being another one. But Russell Westbrook, you know, his athleticism from the time he was a junior in high school, I think, until then we go back and, you know, when he was playing against us at Cal,
His sophomore year, he had that dunk.
Incredible dunk when over Jamal Boykin. And I mean, he just had so many of those kinds of plays. His athleticism is just, he's in the top 1% of athletes, period, in not just in basketball, but I mean, incredible. And there's only been a couple of guys that I've seen where, like I said, they've changed so much that you wouldn't even know who they were. You wouldn't recognize them physically. And I think he's a hell of a player, but sometimes he does rely on his athleticism a little too much. Like I said, he was special. Even, at UCLA, he really didn't play the point. He was really off the ball most of the time, but he was their defensive kind of stopper on a very talented team. I mean, that team went to the Final Four, won the league, et cetera. You got Kevin Love was on that team. Darren Collison. I think there's probably five or six NBA players on the team. I just can't think of them all on the top of my head. But
yeah, they're stacked. Totally stacked. Listen, I love your perspective. Obviously, you pop you on some more. Thanks so much for joining us.
You got it.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
All right, thanks to my brother Greg. That was awesome. Unbelievable insight. I think the Rockets are done. They're just too tired. Same thing for the Nuggets. I'll be interested to see exactly what happens with Milwaukee and the Heat. I think the Milwaukee's in big trouble, and I do think the Celtics had the makeup to kind of reclaim their advantage in this series. Maybe it's because I picked it on our website that I liked the Celtics coming out of that series. I still like the Bucks coming out of their series. Lakers and Clippers will match up in the Western Conference. Thanks so much for downloading and listening. Don't forget to rate and review it. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and this is All Ball.